Good morning, everybody. James Lee, alcoholic. I'm extra nervous this morning because in the room is not only my wife, but my mom. So, few thank yous first. Thanks to Dan for the introduction. He didn't mention it, but Dan and I first met in June of 2000. So, longtime friends. One of those folks I've met in AA that's become a brother. So it's good to see you here, and thank you for that introduction. I also want to thank Dick. Thank you so much for inviting Jane and I. It's been really, wow, what an honor. And what a beautiful place, huh? Gosh. I woke up this morning, and in an attempt to let the light of God shine in my life. I opened the blinds, you know. I opened the blinds, and what a beautiful view out there with the leaves changing. And, man, how fortunate. I have some other thank yous I want to say. I want to thank the speakers that have come before. Lily, I missed you Thursday. I can't wait to hear you later today. Ralph, great talk last night. I'm also excited to hear you tomorrow. And I'm super excited to hear my mom speak tomorrow as well, Polly. And you guys know Polly? Yeah. Yeah. She's my mom. And I have a joke about my mom. It's my favorite joke. Would you guys like to hear it? It's her favorite joke that I tell, too. So, just so you know, it's mother approved, okay? And I'm not a comedian, I'm not a joke teller, so if I botch it, bear with me, okay? You ready? Now I gotta set it up a little bit. Here it comes. So my mom's Polly P. You've heard of her? Yeah. Anybody know what the P stands for? Pistol. Polly Pistol. Now, you guys who know Polly, is there a more perfect last name for that woman? She's a pistol, is she not? Yeah, she's a pistol, all right. Yeah. Well, if you think she's a pistol now, you should have seen her loaded. That's it. That's my best joke. So as a speaker, you should never lead with the best, but there it is. You just got it, so I love that joke. She does. You do too, right? Yeah. All right. And most importantly, I want to thank my beautiful wife, Jane, for being here. And what an honor it was to be on a panel with her yesterday. And she and I have had the privilege of doing these AA things together on occasion. And what a gift. So I love you, and I'm so glad you're here. Okay. My nerves, yeah, I know, I'm like that sometimes. Okay, I think my thank yous are out of the way, so I'm going to get to talking about step one, two, three. In order to do that, I have to tell a little bit about my life growing up. And, you know, we alcoholics love to start with our first drink, don't we? There's something about that first drink. Well, I'm going to tell you about my first drink. I was five. And by this time, I was living in an alcoholic home, and my mom, as an alcoholic, was also visiting Air Force doctors who would give her little pills in these little pill bottles. They used to call them mother's little helpers. You know the ones I'm talking about? Okay. I was five, and we were driving in the car. All right, so I don't know where we were driving. I think it was cross country or something. So my dad's driving in the driver's seat, my mom's in the passenger seat. Behind her is my brother, and behind my dad was me. And now let me tell you, I was a handful at five, all right? She's laughing. It's, I was a handful. I was in trouble all the time. I was high energy. And I would bounce around wherever, in whatever space I was. Not fun to be around. Well, this day, I was extra rambunctious. I was extra talkative, extra bouncing around in the back seat, and my dad was going, "What is going on with him?" And my poor brother, I was beating up on him. He's 2 years older than me. And And my mom goes, "Oh my God!" And she reaches behind it was one of those bench seats. Remember those in those cars? She reaches behind the bench, grabs her purse up, pulls out a now empty bottle of pills. And this was before the days of childproof caps, right? This is 1967. So anyway, 1967. And it was now empty. And it happened to be an empty bottle of pills that she got from an Air Force doctor that was speed. And I ate whatever was left in that bottle of pills. And I was bouncing around the back. Well, they got all excited about that. And took me to the doctor. And the doctor said, he looked me over and said, "Well, it's too late to pump his stomach. Let's see what happens." Yeah, that was five. So I stayed sober for 10 years. And my first real experience was at the age of 15. But I need to tell you a little bit about these 10 years. Since I'm talking about step one, two, and three, I think it's important for me to tell the following story, which is really my mom's story, but I'm going to tell it because this is what I witnessed. And I'm telling this because of the experience I had witnessing what I'm about to describe had a profound effect on me. So very briefly, many of you probably heard her story. The late months of 1976, she was bouncing in and out of treatment facilities and detoxes in Tarrant County, Texas. We lived in Bedford Hearst, Texas. Yeah, there you go. And she was introduced to AA. Loved AA. Didn't think she was an alcoholic. One day, she didn't want to live anymore. And she went to one of these Air Force doctors, got a bottle of Valium, went to a liquor store, got a bottle of scotch. Checked herself into that famous motel in Euless, Texas that Ralph mentioned last night. And took that bottle of pills and drank that bottle of scotch and waited to die. And a friend of hers, who's not an alcoholic, had this feeling come over her that something's wrong with Polly, and she started driving around Hearst, Euless, Bedford. They call it the mid-cities because they're all kind of jammed up together there in Tarrant County. So she's driving around, and she goes by this motel in Euless, Texas, sees my mom's car. And it's one of those motels where you park right out front of the door. You know those kinds? So she's parked out front of the door. Her friend knocked on the door. It happened to be opened, I guess. My mom was too drunk to shut the door. Pushed it open, and there my mom was on the floor, passed out. Her friend dialed 911, and the ambulance came, picked up my mom, and my mom flatlined on the way to the hospital. They resuscitated her. She came to in the emergency room. The doctor said to her, "If I were you, I'd never drink again," and that was not her last drink. Now, obviously, it worked out, didn't it? But that was that experience. In April, late March 77, or early April, somewhere around there. And that was not her last drink. Her last drink came not too long after that, on April 11th, 1977, where she was checked into treatment. Now, I want to tell you, she was court-committed to treatment. And the reason she was court-committed to treatment is that my dad, who was a Al-Anon, an enabling Al-Anon, when all this was going on, had started to go to Al-Anon meetings. And in a very short order, he was transformed by the program of Al-Anon from an enabling guy, husband, to a man who had his wife court committed to treatment. Thank God. And I believe my mom's alive today because of that. So I want to just give a shout out to all you Al-Anons out there for that. Let's give those Al-Anons a hand. Sure had a profound effect on my family. All right. Now, I was a 14-year-old kid, and I was a pretty smart kid. And here's what I saw. This is just my experience. My experience was, if you're an alcoholic and you drink, you'll die. I literally saw that happen. I mean, I wasn't there, but I knew that shortly after I knew it had happened. So at the age of 14, lesson number one. You're an alcoholic, you drink, you're going to die. All right. Shortly thereafter, treatment center, Center Hospital, Dallas, Texas. And they had something called Family Day. Do Did they have family day here in Georgia at the treatment facilities? Okay. Family day looked like this at this particular treatment facility. My mom was, of course, a patient there. My dad and brother and I walked in. So it was my mom, the alcoholic, my dad, the now black belt Al-Anon, my brother, who was 16, and me, who was 14, and the therapist, who was working at the treatment facility. I remember walking into the office. This is my memory. I don't know if this is true, but I'm pretty sure it is. Because, I don't know, anybody relate to this? I remember things that never happened. Anyway, I'm pretty sure this was true. I walked into this office, and hanging on the wall were the steps and traditions. Is this true? You don't remember. Probably not yet. Let's say it's true. Okay. I'm going to believe it. Whoa, I'm going to believe it's true. So steps and traditions. Never seen them before. There they were. And now the purpose of this gathering, I believe, was for this therapist to share with the family. That was my brother and I, really, because my dad had been going to Al-Anon. So to share with my brother and I about alcoholism, about mom, about this, what's going on, about the disease, etc. And I want you to know that I went into that room, and this woman had credibility in my eyes. I don't know why. She just seemed to know what she was talking about. She started talking about, and I remember I was 14, and she started talking about alcoholism. And she began to describe alcoholism. Now, I'm going to report to you what I heard her say. All right? Now, we've already established that she may never have, in fact, said this. But this is what I heard her say. I'm pretty sure she said this stuff. Because I'd never heard it before. And she began to describe alcoholism. Now, I'm going to report what she said. I do not want to in any way suggest that this is the definition of every alcoholic, okay? So you know where the definition of every alcoholic is? It's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I heard this day had a profound effect on me, and here's what she described alcoholism as. She said, alcoholics are people who are uncomfortable in their own skin. And many of them walk around with this feeling of discomfort and dread and like they're like from another planet or something, and so the way it looks for some people is they like have clenched fists and they grind their teeth, and somewhere in their body is this chronic pain. And I thought to myself, man, that is me exactly at the age of 14. At the age of 14, I had this pain right here. I'm pointing to my sternum. Right here. It was a chronic ache. It was I often would walk around with difficulty taking a breath. It's like I would take these shallow breaths. I can remember, you know, it's like how often would I take a deep breath? I don't even know. And so she was describing alcohol, and I was like, man, I identify with that. Then she said, alcoholics are people who have this idea of the way the world should be. And if the rest of the world would only behave, it would be an amazing place to live. Now, I don't know if any of you identify with that. I knew at the age of 14 that my vision of reality, the way things should be, was so great that if you just followed my orders, you would love the result. I knew it. And you know what? It's in the big book. Did you know that? Let me see if I can find it real quick. It says, trust me, it's in here. I can't find it. This is not this is my mom's book, so anyway. Here it is. Everybody, he said, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. That was me. I knew at the age of 14 how the world should be. Then she said, this one killed me. She said, alcoholics suffer from something called belligerent defiance. And if you tell an alcoholic to stand up, they're going to sit down. You tell them to shut up, they're going to start talking. And I was a defiant 14-year-old. Maybe it's because I was a teenager, but let me tell you, I'm 57, and I'm a defiant 57-year-old. So that's my character. And she said a few other things to describe alcoholism, and then she got to the closing, if you will. She closed the deal with this. She said, if you are, now by the way, I'm about to report what she said. I have never found this in any AA-approved literature. Okay? So what I'm about to report to you, I don't know if it's true. And it doesn't matter if it's true. Because when I was 14 and I heard her say it, I believed it. That's what's important. She said this, if you are a child of an alcoholic, you have a 50-50 chance of being an alcoholic yourself. And I was like, oh, man, that's bad news. And then now math was my best subject. And I knew what 50-50 meant. And remember, it was my dad, my mom, my brother, and me. And I looked at my brother. She just described alcoholism. I identified down the line. I looked at my brother. I looked at me, and I said, it ain't going to be him. Right? It's going to be me. So at the age of 14, here's what I knew. If I drank, I was going to become an alcoholic. Alcoholics who drink die. That's what I knew. And you know what? I was given a gift at the age of 14. That gift is described in our big book, too. It's called self-knowledge. I had self-knowledge. I was a smart kid. I made a commitment that day. I'm never going to drink. If I drink, I'm going to be an alcoholic. If I become an alcoholic, I'm going to die. I'm never going to drink. That makes sense, doesn't it? Made complete sense to me at the age of 14. And I want you to know I didn't drink. I didn't. For 5 months, I didn't drink, right? And then the day came where I drank. And I believe this. It had to happen. It had to happen that day, or it had to happen 5 years from then, or it had to happen 5 decades. It was going to happen because I'm an alcoholic. And part of my alcoholism that I don't remember her talking about, but I have learned since in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I suffer from a disease that's spiritual in nature. And for me, I think that a disease that's spiritual in nature demands a spiritual solution. And at the age of 15, I found that spiritual solution, and it was called alcohol. Now, I'll tell you my real first drunk, and I'm going to tell it to you because, you know, like I said, we alcoholics love to talk about it. It wasn't alcohol, though. Now, let me plant you back and go in the time machine back. It was September 1977. I was 15 years old. If anyone remembers 77, what was 1977? It was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, man. It was Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, Beatles, you know, all that was it. And I was 15. I went to school that day, and let me tell you about the kid I brought to school. It was the same kid I brought to school every day. This kid, me, I felt apart from, less than, and different. I felt unloved and unlovable. I felt like there was something wrong with me. I also already described to you, I had this chronic pain right here behind my sternum that I couldn't satisfy. I knew there was something wrong with me. I knew all these kids knew the secret to life. I didn't know it. And so I showed up to school this day trying to act like none of that was true. And this kid came up to me. I would find out later his name was David. I didn't know who he was from anybody. I'll describe him to you. He was a junior. I was a sophomore. He had long hair, a Led Zeppelin t-shirt, and very red eyes. And this is in the morning. And he said, you want to come with us? Let's go. So this was L.D. Bell High School in Bedford, Texas. You know that place? All right, back in the day, there was Brown Trail. Right across the street was this woods. So there are houses there now, but it was woods at the time. We crossed the street, went into the woods. There are these logs set up in a circle. I have a feeling that we were not the first group of high schoolers to do what we were about to do. We sat down. He broke out the rolling papers. You know where this is going. Passed it to me. And I did something I had promised myself 5 months before I'd never do, and I want to tell you something. Thank God I did, man. I found the elixir of life that day. Literally, my life changed like that. The person I brought felt less than, apart from, and different, and just like that, I was somebody. Does anybody identify with this? There's a line in Bill's story. He said, I had arrived. And I'm going to tell you, just thinking about it gets me going, you know? It was something. And I felt that way every time I drank. Now, I'm an alcoholic. It started with that, but I'm telling you, I'm an alcoholic. I loved alcohol. I loved everything else, too. Don't get me wrong. Remember, 1977 until my sobriety date in 1984. And I was from 15 to 21. And I did everything I could get my hands on. And I loved it all. I loved drinking. I loved every bit of it. And everything worked for me. And the thing it did for me, I didn't know this at the time, but the thing it did for me was it altered my perception of reality to made the world a place where I could live in it. That's really what it did for me. It made me capable of walking planet Earth inside my own skin. And I identify what is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have what the doctor's opinion describes as a physical allergy. My allergy worked like this. When I drank, I could not predict what was going to happen. I could go and to the bars. Now, when I was 18, it was legal to drink. Shortly thereafter, it was bumped up to 21, but thank God I was grandfathered in, right? So I was able to drink at the age of 18 in Texas. And I would go get a drink, and sometimes I'd go home. And then sometimes 3 days would go by, I didn't know what happened. And looking back, I could see that kind of level of prediction was becoming less and less predictable. And I believe it's because alcoholism is a progressive illness. And I think had I drank past age 21, it would have gotten to be, that would have been my life, which was take a drink and not know what happened. But every now and then I would be able to control it, which, by the way, for an alcoholic, if you just have a couple and get home, that's considered controlled drinking. And if you can control your drink, I'm air quoting this for those of you all listening. So if you control your drinking, you can convince yourself you're not an alcoholic. Anybody identify with that? Yes, so I'm controlling my drinking. Now, let me tell you this. I skipped over something. This is really important for my story. My mom got sober in April 1977. I had my first drink in September. Those intervening months, stuff happened. Like, my mom would drag me to AA meetings, and I actually went willingly. I thought it was kind of interesting. To the Harbor Club in Fort Worth, Texas. And on Sunday morning, they'd have an open speaker meeting, and I'd go and I'd hear these folks talk, and I'd say, oh, wow, that's a pretty dramatic story, and I don't identify with that. And as long as I don't live that life, I won't be an alcoholic. She also said, you're going to 6 Alateen meetings, whether you like it or not. After that, you can go or not. And I went, and I liked it. One of the reasons, by the way, if you have kids or know anyone going to Alateen, please do not suggest they work this Alateen program, but this is the one I worked. I liked it. Why? Because me and my Alateen friends would get high before the meetings, behind the building. So go behind the building, do our thing, go to the meeting. Go, this is really, you know how great Alateen meetings are? Never mind. Anyway, loved it. And here's why. We were all budding alcoholics, probably. And I've always loved alcoholics, man. I love them today. I love them drunk. I love them sober. Always have. Anyway, so this is this part I really want to share because, my mom gets sober in April, and then I'm starting my story a few months later, and she's kind of starting to come to. You know where the step two says came to believe? Well, she came to AA, and then she started to come to, and she started looking around her life, and her eyes fell on me, working up my story, right? Getting high, getting drunk. And she said to me this, and by the way, if you have kids or know people who have kids, I do not recommend you say the following to a 15-year-old. You ready? James, we're saving a seat for you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot wait for you to get here. I have a sponsor picked out for you. You can join my home group. And you and I can trudge this road of happy destiny together, right? She said that. And I said, oh, no. And I said, maybe the battle cry of the alcoholic. You ready? don't you know who you're talking to? You may be a weak alcoholic. And those people that you go to, those losers in AA, you guys may be weak. But my case is different. My case is different. And I had this idea, learned from these meetings I went to from the Harbor Club. And I think the main thing was I had convinced myself that the last thing I wanted to be was an alcoholic. And so I had this sort of definition of an alcoholic over here. And as long as I did not meet that definition, I wasn't an alcoholic. So here's the definition. This is what I heard from those meetings that I would go to. To be an alcoholic, you had to get divorced. Preferably a number of times. To the same person. You know, for the same person. Now, if you do that, you're an alcoholic. Am I right? Come on. I'd never been divorced. Right? Of course, I'd never been married, but to be an alcoholic, you had to wreck your car in very dramatic fashion. And I say, as long as I don't wreck my car, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, I would wreck my car. In Texas, we call them whiskey dents. You ever have any whiskey dents where you just kind of tap somebody, maybe lose a headlight, or, you know, your trunk doesn't shut right, but it's still drivable, right? That's not a real wreck. That's a whiskey dent. I remember this guy had a pickup truck with the tailgate down, and I was driving a VW Bug, and he was stopped at a light, and I sort of went, uh-oh, and I hit the brakes and sort of swerved, and I hit him right with my, you know those Bugs had those, I hit him right with my headlight, right in the back. It didn't do anything to his tailgate, but it went with my headlight, and I drove around like that. It was drivable, so I hadn't had a wreck. Let's see, what else? You had to be homeless to be an alcoholic. All these people who were telling their stories, they were homeless. I was never homeless. I did sleep in my car for a while, but that doesn't count. So, in my mind. You see, this is my mind we're talking about. Okay. What else? You had to go to treatment. Now, everybody my age in Northeast Tarrant County in the early 1980s was going to treatment. You guys remember those years? Everybody was going to treatment. My friends were going. I remember one of my dealers, his name was Rick, went to treatment, came back a completely different person. He wasn't sober, he was heavily medicated. But anyway, if he went, everybody was going. I never went to treatment. Can you believe that? And the kicker, number five here, is an alcoholic, you go to jail or prison. All these stories, they were in jail or prison. I have never been to jail or prison. Now, let me check that. I've been sober because I do corrections work. But I've never been locked up. I've never been arrested. Can you believe that? Can you believe that a self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous stands up here and admits he's never been arrested? Never been arrested. Am I alone here? Okay, thank God. So I thought to myself, in my mind, I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. And as long as those things don't happen, as long as I don't get divorced, wreck my car, homeless, treatment, or prison, I won't be alcoholic. So that was my definition. And I said, if I can keep all that stuff from happening, I'm not going to be alcoholic. None of those things happened. By the way, this idea that I kept them from happening is really quite arrogant. But the truth is none of those things happened. I mean, it's just not my story. And the fact that those things didn't happen kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. The other thing that kept me out of Alcoholics Anonymous is this idea that if I was to admit I was an alcoholic, I would lose the battle. And from the age of 15, I said to myself, I'm going to beat this thing. And there's a line in the Big Book that I really identify with, and it's basically this, the great obsession of every alcoholic is to be a normal drinker. That was going to be me. And as long as I could keep this stuff from happening, not an alcoholic. And I lived my life like that for 6.5 years. Now, obviously, none of those things happened, so I don't have any big dramas to tell you about. There's no exciting drunk logs. I did a lot of things that other drunks do. I would get drunk and black out, wake up in strange places, but nothing super dramatic. I have a friend of mine, Lon, from Jacksonville. I love to hear his story. He was in the Marines. He once got drunk in the Philippines. He was stationed over there. Blacked out and woke up, came to in Australia. Now that is a great... I wanted that story. I would get drunk in Hearst, Texas, black out, and come to in Bedford, Texas. That was maybe like 100 feet right over there. So that's as far as I got. So anyway, I'm not an alcoholic. And but the truth is I was an alcoholic. But I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I had this definition of an alcoholic that it's what alcohol does to you. You know, these circumstances, these... And it took me a long time in AA to learn this, that alcoholism isn't what alcohol does to me, it's what it does for me. And what it does for me happened that very day when I was 15. And that is that one drink, my life changes. That's why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because when I drink, I can't predict what's going to happen. I'm also an alcoholic, and Ralph mentioned this last night, was because when I'm not drinking, that's what I'm thinking about. That's why I'm an alcoholic. But I'm going to tell you why I think I'm an alcoholic even more in a minute. But I identify with those things in the big book. And I believe this. This is just my belief. And I believe it because I read it in the big book and it resonated with me as the truth. And that is that my problem has nothing to do with alcohol. My problem is that I have a spiritual illness. And it's not a coincidence to me that when I point to where I ached, it was right here. And this is kind of where the center of my being is, and my soul, if you will. And I would walk around planet Earth with this chronic ache in the center of my soul. That was my problem. And then at the age of 15, I found an answer. And that solution worked for me for a long time. Every time I drank, I would get relief. And it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. After a few drinks, that restlessness, discontent, and irritability would be replaced with a sense of ease and comfort. That's exactly what I got when I drank. And that's why I drank. I remember at the age of 15, don't drink. If you drink, you're going to be an alcoholic and you're going to die. Fast forward to me drinking, I don't care. I just want to feel this way. I don't know if I thought this thought at the age of 15, that first experience there across the street from Melody Bell High School, but I sure lived it, and that was this. I'm going to do whatever it takes every day for the rest of my life to feel this way. And that's exactly what I did. I'm one of those alcoholics that drank or did whatever every single day. I would get up, I would get what I needed, and I'd go about my day. I could probably count on the fingers of both hands the number of days in that 6.5 years where I was not under the influence. I had to have it because it was the only sense of ease and comfort that I could find. And this is what I believe. I believe that alcohol was my solution to alcoholism. And I think many alcoholics can identify with that, right? I found the solution to my problem. And I remember folks would say to me, man, you need to stop drinking. That's a real problem for you. And I'd say, oh, no, you don't understand, man. It's my answer. And what I've learned is that for this alcoholic, alcohol is the second best treatment I've ever found for alcoholism. And the best treatment is here in AA. And it worked. It worked for a long time. My sad part of my story is it stopped working. I'm going to just tell this real quick. So my sobriety day is January 3rd, 1984. And my story is this. December 31st, 1983, I went to a New Year's Eve party somewhere in Fort Worth, Texas. I started drinking and doing other stuff. And the next thing I know, this is my last memory of the night. I'm on my hands and knees crawling on the front porch of this house. I remember like it was yesterday. It's kind of a grayish paint, wooden slatted front porch. And I was crawling, trying to get to the railing on the other side of which were the bushes so I could throw up and not make a mess that I had to deal with, and blacked out. The next thing, January 3rd, 1984, and I came to this morning. And this is what I believe. I don't know this for a fact, but I believe it because it was true on December 30th and December 31st. I believe this. On January 2nd, I was not an alcoholic. I had tried and tried. This is my great obsession, not to be an alcoholic. And on January 2nd, I'm certain I was an alcoholic. Don't you know who you're talking to? And more importantly, I wanted to be drunk. And then I came to this morning, January 3rd, and I had what I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous described as a moment of clarity. And I saw myself for who I really was for the first time in my life. So the day before, not an alcoholic, wanting to be drunk. I came to and I'm like, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. And then the next thought was, and I want to be sober. I can't believe this. Now what I believe is Ralph was talking about last night. God's grace entered my life that night, that morning. And I haven't had a drink since. How about that? January 3rd, 1984. And, okay, so I'm 21 and a half. Man, I'm an alcoholic. What the heck? I don't want to drink. Wow. What do you do? What do you do? So I'm going to tell you what I did. Please don't judge me, okay? Okay? That was Joe C. You're next, brother. Too late. I did what the only thing I knew to do. I called my mom. Okay, that's what I did. Mom, you're not going to believe this. I'm an alcoholic. And she said, James, no kidding. You know, no kidding. And she said, oh, I've been praying for this day. And I'm like, oh, God, here we go. And I said, Mom, and I want what you have. I want to be sober. And she said, James, I think you should go to AA. And I said, Mom, I don't want it that bad. I hung up the phone. Click. Forget it. I'm not going to AA. The lamest place in the world. Remember, I just spent 6.5 years making a case against Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to AA. Forget it. Now, what happened was, that day, I believe God separated me from alcohol and all the other stuff. And I haven't had a drink since. Now, that didn't stop me from being an alcoholic. But I wouldn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if anyone's ever done this experiment. And that is not drink and not go to AA or treat alcoholism in some other way. I had the second best treatment I would ever find in this life for alcoholism literally removed from me. That's alcohol. And I did not replace it with any other treatment. And this is why I know I'm an alcoholic. And that is this. I got worse. My life got worse. I thought, I had this weird idea, this delusional idea that if I removed alcohol, if alcohol was taken from my life, I would get better. And in fact, the opposite happened. I got worse. I got so sick, you guys. I have never been this sick in my life. I'm talking about sick physically and mentally, emotionally and spiritually. And the reason why is that I suffer from a spiritual malady that demands treatment. The treatment that had worked more or less in my life was removed, and I did not replace it with anything else. And boy, did I get sick. And this lasted for months. And I kept getting sicker and sicker, and I kept wondering, what is going on here? And I believe I was a drunk waiting to drink. And now, looking back on this experience I had on January 3rd, I want to tell this real quick. I don't recall asking for that experience. I don't recall saying, God, please get me sober. All I know is I woke up and it happened. And I believe that was God's grace that was given to me without my consent. Really. And so I'm an example of someone for whom God can work in my life without my consent. And that happened that day. And here's another example of God working in my life without my consent. This was months later. I don't even remember. I'm going to call it 11 months. So we're going to say it's December 1984. I am a alcoholic, not in recovery. I would occasionally go to AA meetings. I was doing the program. Anybody had ever done this? I was practicing sobriety. I don't know if anyone's ever done that. I was practicing the sobriety program, and I was what I would call a fringe member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ever heard of this idea? Here's how it looked like in my life. I would come in late and I'd leave early. You get a big book like this? Forget it. I'm not going to get the big book. Sponsor? No way. I'd sit in the back row of the meeting, and my sponsor Frank would call the back row the shoe section. You ever hear this? It's where the sneakers and the loafers and the slippers sit. Back there. Present company excluded, you guys. Not many seats up here. You're good back there. But for me, when I was sitting back there, I was waiting to take a drink. And that was the program of sobriety that I was practicing. And I believe I would have got drunk in short order. And then another miracle happens. Here it is. I'm sitting at home. Today I call it solitude. Back then I would have called it isolating. And I got a phone call from a woman my mom sponsored, Barbara. And she said, James, I've called every woman I know. I have a woman I sponsor. She needs to get to a meeting. None of the women I know can take her. Will you please take her? And I'm sitting there going, I don't want to do this. Why would I do this? What's in it for me? Nothing. And I heard myself, I'm selfish, self-centered, right? Heard myself say yes. So I picked this woman up. I didn't know who she was. I've never seen her since. Took her to a meeting. And the meeting layout was kind of like, see these two tables right here? Put them end to end. That was the layout of the meeting. I sat down, and this dude comes in and sits right across from me, and that dude happened to be the speaker that night. And that guy told his story, and this was 11 months without a drink. First time in my life, and I've been to AA meetings, when I was a kid. First time I ever heard anyone tell my story. And that guy was fired up for AA. He was full of hope for life, and I caught it. I caught my alcoholism that day. And so you know what I say? I went to one meeting too many. One meeting too many. Now, I did not want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you. I did not want to be here. And when I'm asked to share like this, I always say this. If you are sitting here tonight and you don't want to be here, welcome. And I mean it. Welcome. I sat in meetings of AA, again, in the back row. I did not want to be there. And then I went to a meeting and the miracle happened without my consent once again. And I just went to one meeting too many. So if you identify with what I experienced, my hope for you is you go to a meeting and hear somebody tell your story. And I joined AA and I've never looked back. I think that moment where I sat in that meeting was my second step. I believed, because I saw it in this guy's life, I believe that there was a power that took an interest in me personally. That's what I believe. And I think I took my second step that day and I joined AA. Got a sponsor, started working the steps. And we got up to step 3. And we read some stuff out of the big book. I'm going to read just a little bit here because there's some stuff in step 3 in the big book that I really resonate with. I just read one to you. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people do as he wished, the show would be great. Remember that? That was me. Then it talks about the alcoholic, in order to make that happen, may be kind, considerate, quite virtuous. I call that manipulative. Okay, so if I want to get you to do what I want, I'll manipulate you. Now, if that doesn't work, then it says I may be mean, egotistical, and what I can bully you. So I'm either going to manipulate you or bully you to get you to do what I want you to do. And if you did what I want you to do, life would be great. Am I right? Okay. Problem is, you have your own idea of what life should be like. Yours and my idea is likely different, which means that when I push on you, either through manipulation or through bullying, I'm going to step on your toes and you're going to retaliate. And it's going to be seemingly without provocation, which means I'm going to think, whatever, what was that all about? And then something is going to happen, and I'm going to cop a resentment against you. And that is described so well in the pages in step 3 here. And that's exactly how I live my life. I had an idea of what I wanted. I tried to get you to do it. You wouldn't do it. I step on your toes. You'd retaliate. And now it's all your fault. And then there's this line in the big book, I think I mentioned this yesterday, that I didn't like at all. It says this, so we think his problems are of his own making. That's what that line is in step three. I learned that, I read that, and I said, oh, it may be true for you, it's not true for me. My problems are not my own making. You're my problem. You are my problem. And if you just behave, life would be great. I don't know if anyone can identify with this. But that's how I felt. And it took me some time to learn that what it says in the book is exactly the truth. That my problems are of my making. And thank God for that. Now that doesn't mean the world is a perfect place to live in. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the world that maybe isn't great, but it's my reaction to it. Right? It's how I respond to life. That's my problem. And thank God there's an answer to what my problem is. And that's the rest of the steps that these folks are going to talk about. But I was presented with step three, and my sponsor took me through this part of the book. And there's one line I'm going to read. And I love this line, so bear with me. Because this is my problem, and I'm going to get to something else. Here's what it says. This is middle of page 61. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if he only manages well? You guys heard of this line? First of all, it says victim of the delusion. When I first read that, I said, I know Bill Wilson. I didn't know him. But he didn't mean victim, did he? Come on. There's no victims. Victim of the delusion. But you know what? The more I think about it, the more I work with this work, I believe it. I was a victim of the delusion. That means I had a delusion that of and by myself, with my own power, I could not get free from. I had to have help to be free from this delusion that I had in my mind. So in a way, I was a victim. And it's the delusion is that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if I only manage well. So I think about this word rest. You've heard this word, right? It's part of wrestle. And when I read that, I said, I know what rest means. And I don't know if anyone can identify with this, but I know what words mean, so I never have to look them up in the dictionary. Anybody identify with that? I looked it up one day because I felt like it. And this is Google here. So Google, you can type in a word, and up comes the definition. Here it is. Forcibly pull something from a person's grasp. That sounds about right. Take something, especially power or control, from someone or something else after considerable effort or difficulty. Yeah, that's me with happiness. I'm going to pull happiness out of life if it kills me. All right? Now, this is what got me right here. And this is a definition of rest. See if anyone identifies with this definition. You ready? Now, this is a big thing for me. So here comes. This is an archaic meaning of the word. Distort the meaning or interpretation of something to suit one's own interests or views. Let me say that again, in case you missed it. Distort the meaning or interpretation of something to suit one's own interests or views. That is my problem right there. I look at the world and I make it into whatever idea of the world I have in my mind. I have a perception problem. And I'm going to put this perception on the world, and I'm going to make it, try to fit it if it kills me. And what happened is it just about did. And then it affects every relationship that I have in my life because I push on you and step on your toes. And that's the way I lived. And so we got to this point in the book, and my sponsor at the time said, let's go. We're going to do the third step prayer. And this is what he did. He was a guy who believed in doing prayer like on our knees, holding hands and stuff. So he pushed away this coffee table. We were sitting on the couch, pushed away the coffee table, and I was going, what is going on here? On his knees he goes, and I'm like, and he says, come on. So I did. I held his hand. I said the third step prayer. And, you know, the sky didn't part. The lightning didn't strike. But for some reason I felt better. I felt a little bit better. And he said to me, what we're doing here is you're making a decision. And up to that time, I made a lot of decisions that I hadn't followed through with. But he said, you're going to make this decision, and you're going to follow through with it. And this decision is to do the rest of the steps It really is that simple for me. Step three is deciding to do whatever's necessary to get a relationship with God. That's promised in step 12. And that means do steps 4 through 11. That's it. That's step 3 for me. And I did that day, and I followed through with it, and I did the rest of the steps. And a bunch of folks are going to talk about those, and my experience at the end of it is I got a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I found the real treatment for alcoholism through that work. And I do that today, so when I'm working with someone, I say, the way I do this is on my knees, holding hands, saying the third step prayer. Are you up for it? And they'll go, what? I'll say, let's do it. And that's what we do. And so that was my experience with step three. And again, it wasn't in any colossal sort of mind-blowing experience. I just felt a little bit better. And I followed through on that commitment. That's all I can say about it. So how's it look today? Now what I'm going to share with you is my experience, okay? I don't mean to say this is the way to work the steps, but this is what I do. So take it or leave it. If you don't like this, just kick it under your chair. But I work steps 1, 2, and 3 every morning. And it happens, that later in the book there's a line that says, on awakening. So what that means to me is that when I wake up, that means first moment of consciousness, I do the following. I did it this morning. I say in prayer, God, I have no power, and my life is entirely unmanageable by me, by myself. And you have the power. And I believe that you will work in my life. And then I say the third step prayer. And then I say the seventh step prayer, which is coming later. And then I say my version of the third step prayer. And I'm going to share this with you. I got this from Chuck Chamberlain. And by the way, Chuck is my third favorite AA speaker I've ever heard. Now, just for the record, my favorite is my wife, Jane. And my second favorite is my mom, Polly. All right, so Chuck is in good company. Okay? Here's the prayer that I heard from him. He says, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. And I'm going to go out in the world, and I'm going to move things around, and I'm going to try to do the best I can. I hope you give me the inspiration to do it. And I add this a little bit. I say, God, I'm willing to go wherever you want me to go, do whatever you want me to do, see whoever you want me to see, hear whatever you want me to hear, and say whatever you want me to say. You have the power. I don't. And with your help, maybe some of your power will go into the world through me. That's it. And like every morning I did that, and I was just kind of sitting there sort of feeling really good. Because when I do that, I just feel really good. It's just this moment of the day where I surrender to my conception of God. And I'm sitting there, I feel real good. Sometimes I feel literally as if I am sitting safe and protected in the very hands of God. And I sit there about as long as my type A personality can take it. Then I make the biggest mistake of my life. I get up and I go live my life and make all these mistakes and stuff. And there are steps for that later too. All right? So step three, I find this moment of peace. And I want to tell you this is my belief. This alcoholic's belief based on my experience of sobriety. And I'm going to go back to this day, January 3rd, 1984. I'm struck sober by the grace of God. I was surrendered. Do you hear me? I was surrendered. I didn't do anything. I didn't ask for it. It happened. It was an experience that I had where I was surrendered. It was over. I was done. God, I didn't really know what God was this time. I mean, I believed, but I didn't really know. Had surrendered me, and it was done. I was done. Then I pick up the phone. I call my mom. She says, go to AA. And I said, I don't want it that bad. And I hang up the phone. You know what I did? It only took 5 minutes. My ego reconstructed itself. And it happened like that. It literally happened for me in 5 minutes. And I love this analogy. I don't know where it came from. I heard Clancy came up with it, or Peg M. from Nebraska. I don't know, but I'm making it mine. So I'm going to think I'm never going to... I'm going to take credit from now on. But here it is, you guys. I heard Peg say, she said, that moment where I was surrendered, it was as though I threw in the towel. You know this this boxing analogy where the boxer's getting beat up really bad, and to surrender, they